It is November 24th, 2013, and this is episode 44 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell, and as usual, tonight joining me is Mr. Andrew Kellett.
Good evening, Jerry. Good to see you.
Likewise. And as usual, the thoughts and opinions we express on this podcast are ours and do not represent those of our employer. So, as keeping in tradition, I did have a discussion with my friend Bob, and he had just one piece of advice for all you people out there, and that was, if you have a server on the internet, patch it, right? Just patch it.
I'm not sure I understand.
I know it's a complicated concept, right? But it should be patched. If it's on the internet, it should be patched.
So, inspired by your Bob stories, I did want to share one quick story from a conversation I had this week with one of my customers who was having a malware problem. And, you know, mid-sized company, not a very elaborate and expensive security posture at the moment. And, you know, it was funny in talking with them. It's amazing how IT groups get sort of tunnel vision. And just giving them some basic suggestions of a patch management system and keeping things, you know, well patched and having good understanding of what's out on the desktops. I think there's a lot of value in getting, I guess what I'm saying is there's a lot of value in getting an outside, non-emotional, independent input into your situation, because we get tunnel vision when we're down deep in our own trenches at times. And, you know, these guys were, you know, the other thing that came up, and this was the thing that, the other really thing that I wanted to mention was, they had technology deployed. Like, they have a next-gen firewall, which is a marketing term, but they didn't have things like the IPS functionality enabled. And, you know, the first thing we went through is when they were telling me they were having all these problems, I asked for kind of a rundown inventory of what sort of gear they already had in place. And you know, you might have, if you're having problems and you don't have budget to fix, good thing to do is reassess what you already have out there and see if you can use it in ways that are meant to be used, but you haven't enabled yet. Which I see a lot. I see a lot of folks, especially with firewall technology today, there's a lot of functionality. It may not be great, may not be the perfect functionality, but it's something. And if you're, you know, getting hit, it's always good to explore what your current technology you already have in place can do.
That's a really great point. It kind of reminds me a little bit of something you and I experienced way at the beginning of the millennium.
Are we talking about that weekend in Vegas?
No. We don't talk about that one. No, right. I'm talking about Japan. Remember, Japan had firewalls in place, and they were fully protected. And when we looked at their firewalls, their policies were any except.
Which is a wonderful policy for routing traffic.
Packets. It gets the job done.
Packets just want to be free, Jerry.
That's right.
Package just want to be free.
That's right. But you bring up a great point. You know, a lot of companies have technology that they're not fully using, and you know, look at it. So, the first story we're going to talk about tonight comes from Reuters, and this is it's a FBI. A bulletin that was released, and it indicates that the Department of Health and Human Services and a few other government agencies had been compromised, and 104,000 employee and relative information. So, you know, I don't know exactly what that means. I would assume things like name, birthday, address, social security number, that sort of thing, and 2,000 bank accounts were apparently involved in this data breach. There's really not a lot of information about how it happened, But apparently there is a link to Anonymous asserted by the FBI.
So, Jerry, really quick.
Yes.
When I was reading this, I read it as 20,000 bank accounts with the comma in the wrong place as a typo, because there are four zeros on the end of that in the article.
Thank you. Yes, I'm looking at that and I see that. You're right.
I'm not sure which is accurate. So it's either 20,000 or 2,000. But just for the sake of accuracy, I did note that.
Hey, that's a great strategy.
Right.
when you're writing press releases.
Randomly put the comma somewhere and... Yep. Anyway, sorry to take you off thread there.
No, that's a good correction. Thank you.
And
there's apparently some possibility and I would say probability that it was related to our old friend Cold Fusion.
Yeah.
So, not a lot to say there, except that I think this is another case of. Another government agency apparently being hit by the same kind of thing that quite a few other agencies have been hit by. Now, there was one really interesting assertion or maybe speculation in one of the articles. I don't recall if it was in the Reuters article or not, but someone was pontificating about the possibility of compromising an internal server and distributing malware like a watering hole style attack using an internal server.
That was in the CSO Online article. It's funny because the CSO Online article takes the memo and, okay, I'm putting my ranting hat on for a moment here. And this is such a common tactic of a lot of the technical press, and it frustrates the hell out of me. So they get some sort of article or topic, and then they start calling executives at InfoSec vendors. And the InfoSec vendors use whatever topic they're calling about to pimp their wares.
Hey, it's like a politician, right?
Absolutely. So how do you feel about killing children in Africa? I'm really glad you asked me that, Alex. So let's talk about clean water in Canada. Like, what? And so here's what frustrates me a little bit is, so you're absolutely correct. And what you referenced is the CSO Online article. I'm going to torture this name, so I'm going to try it. The founder and chief executive of Invincia, which is kind of a virtualization software for the desktop that's meant to fight malware, and it's interesting. It's worth looking at. But what he did was he kind of went, well, we don't know what happened, but I bet it started internally with a phishing campaign and then was pushed out to the endpoints, right? Or to the websites. Well, of course he's going to say that, because he sells security software for what? Oh, the endpoints. To defend against what? Oh, malware on the endpoints. So he's pimping his own need for his own stuff. Is he wrong? Not necessarily, but it makes it suspect, right? Because his compelling reason is to sell his own software. Now, right, wrong, or different, I don't know if he's right or I don't know if he's wrong, but it immediately calls into question his version of what might have happened, because he's purely speculative. So, it's a bit of a rant, it's a bit off topic, but this is something that frustrated me when I read this about this and you brought it up, is I get that we can get interesting quotes from these guys, but they're not in the know. They don't know any more details, and it just gives them an avenue and a venue to, serve their Kool-Aid.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you there. I guess I thought it was an interesting thing, and clearly we have no indication that's what happened here. And I would actually say it's probably much more like all of the other attacks that have happened in the government, where they've lost data through Cold Fusion exploits.
And to be fair, before, Invincia never speaks to me again, if I were the CEO of Invincia and CSO Magazine called me, I would do the same thing, right? So I don't blame them, but you just have to look at it with a skeptical eye, is all I'm saying.
Absolutely. It's a good point. And I think we all need to think about things in a rational way when we read these kinds of articles, because it does as I recall, does pretty clearly say in there that they don't know exactly how it happened, but hey, it might have happened in this particular way. And, you know, oh, by the way, we have something that might help you out with that. So
right. It's like I tweeted out, if you're a security vendor and you're in sales for that security vendor, and in any way your sales pitch includes anything about, and we would have stopped Snowden, you're doing it wrong.
Yes, regression testing of exploits. That's great.
Yeah, yeah. I had three different vendors this week use that tactic in talks with me, and I just, it's like nails on chalkboard.
All right.
Sorry. Can you tell I'm just a little cranky?
He's a little cranky tonight.
I apologize.
It's okay.
I even warned Jerry before the podcast started. I said.
He did. He did warn me.
And it didn't. He still let me come on the show.
He did warn me. All right. Let's move on. The next is a lovely story by Krebs on Security. And it is about Cupid Media being hacked. And 42 million user accounts have been disclosed, right? So I would say that as much as I like Brian Krebs, and you know, I have the man crush on him, he's really doing the whole Glenn Greenwald thing with the Snowden documents here. You know, apparently earlier in the year he found a server through some mechanism that hasn't yet been disclosed that had kind of a pot of stuff on it, and basically he's been bleeding out the stuff that has been found on it, and the latest revelation is this pile of 42 million user IDs. And what's really awesome about this is, you know, they're unencrypted passwords, which is, you know, just fantastic. And it gets better and weirder, because they contacted the company. So Krebs contacted the company, and the company basically said, oh, maybe that was from earlier in the year, but you know what? There's no indication that that company actually announced publicly or disclosed that they had been hacked earlier in the year. And also, I think Krebs called them out on the unencrypted passwords, and the person from Cupid Media said something to the effect of, well, you must have illegally accessed our member accounts.
Which clearly, the messenger. That's an excellent strategy.
Which is just fantastic. And so I think this is, from my perspective, you know, this is one of those opportunities to look at how horribly wrong you can respond to an incident. You know, so they apparently, as far as we can tell, did get compromised earlier in the year, and they did apparently do some response and apparently move to salted and hashed passwords, but they didn't tell anyone. You know, it's pretty darn important when you run a service with 42 million user accounts and you get compromised and that data gets stolen, you got to tell people.
You know what shocked me the most?
What's that?
This is an Australian dating site, and there's 42 million people in Australia on this dating site. I had no idea there was, you know, that many lonely Australians.
I didn't either.
So that alone, I thought, shocking. But unencrypted passwords. Hey, if you want another rainbow table, boom, there you go. 42 million entries right there.
We are learning so much about the psychology of password picking. It's really not even funny. And I have to wonder, you know, what the carryover effects are going to be into other aspects of marketing and things like that, knowing that, you know, the most popular password is 123456, and the most non-numeric password is I love you, and you know, that sort of thing. It
Jerry, I didn't know you cared.
Well, you know, we said we weren't going to talk about Vegas, okay?
It's true. It's true.
All right. Moving on. We talked about a virus or Trojan a couple of shows ago, and at the time we basically said it was feeling out whether or not the computer it was installed on had SAP running. And so here's an article from TechNet basically saying that there is a version of the Carburp Trojan, and as we all hopefully remember, Carburp itself had been compromised earlier in the year, and its source code had been stolen, which is fantastic into it, you know, in and of itself. But here we have an analysis by Microsoft where they have found that this Carburp Trojan apparently has been modified to specifically target SAP, and it's not just looking to see if SAP is installed. So there's a lot of detail here, but basically this Trojan is keylogging, so whatever you do as far as interacting with the SAP client, it's logging those keystrokes. It is taking screenshots and uploading those screenshots to a command and control server. It is recording the command line arguments that all of the SAP tools are being started with. And it offers, you know, for convenience, of course, the attackers a VNC access to the computer. And dang, this really sounds pretty damning from
It's huge.
For people who are running SAP.
Yeah, just bad guy can watch, capture all your login information, jump on via VNC, and happily go to town on your SAP.
So if you're running SAP, put your helmet on, man. This is potentially about to get pretty interesting.
I did chuckle a bit at Microsoft's mitigating the risk recommendations.
Yes.
I mean, about the only good one. Well, okay, I'll just run down them real quick. Access control, go minimum, least needed privilege. Sure, all right. This is the only one I really like. Two factor. That would probably be helpful for the most part on each login, but that would be a pain in the butt, and people would turn it off quickly. Security education, maybe if you have limited number of people in SAP, maybe. Right, just to stop the initial whatever the infection vector was. Anti-malware software, well, maybe, depending on which anti-malware software and whatever it is the initial vector was. Network intrusion detection system to catch the outbound VNCs, CNC communication. Again, maybe. It depends on what kind of monitoring system. Oh, and security management. Ensure workstations are up to date and patch them, blah, blah, blah. Well, yeah. But again, this is the payload. We don't know what the vector of infection was.
Yeah, so, exactly. There's no indication that this is using some exploit. You know, that's one of the things that really bothers me a lot about how people think about malware these days. And I don't know. I would hope people listening to this show are more sophisticated than that, right? But a lot of malware now is basically just presented to you, the user, on a silver platter in an email. And you click on that email, you open the attachment, there's no exploit required. You know, it's
I thought it came with the ask.com toolbar with Java updates.
That's something entirely different.
Sorry. No, that's right. Java comes with the ask.com toolbar updates. My bad.
Yes, that's right.
I would love, by the way, love to know the metric of how many people actually install ask.com when they either update or load Java. I'm really curious what that percentage is.
I have a little bit of view into that, given a particular opportunity that I am exposed to. So we'll talk about that offline.
All right, fair enough.
It's way to tease
the listeners.
It's a non-trivial percentage, and the problem, right, is that it's that the tick box is checkbox is ticked by default, right?
It's meant to be. Yeah, it's. There's probably some fancy term somebody's come up for it, not bloatware, but some sort of
hanger on
default ware or something. I don't know, but anyway, I completely derailed you. Sorry.
There really is not a great mitigation against this, from a technical perspective, because even two-factor authentication, if you think about it, you've got a situation where the client is logged into the application, and presumably somebody can VNC in now and they can use that active session.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, that's a problem.
There just isn't a great, a great mitigation. The only
Jump
really
box? Really tightly secured jump box, maybe?
that's the only thing that I can come up with is segregation, right? Is
But even then, they could still VNC in when you're on the jump. I mean, there's,
well, I guess it
you know
depends
what?
on how
Just
you.
unplug everything and go back to paper. That's the
That's
plan.
right. That's right.
The hell
Pay,
with
pay the paper-based accounting tables and all that. Yes,
I'm
that.
taking the Battlestar Galactica approach. No networking.
It's great. But at some point, I think the end state, unless something really radical changes in the industry, I think the end state for this is that email and web browsing and all that crap is going to be done in a different place than where you do critical business functions,
I
like
would love
accessing
to agree with
business
you.
applications.
I really would like to agree with you.
I'm not saying that's like next year. I'm saying that's the end state. I think that's the end state.
I'm saying I would like to agree with you.
Fair enough. We can disagree.
On another show, we'll get into. I just think with the rise of BYOD and everything else, it's going the other way.
I don't disagree, but I think there is going to be a burning platform for change. I mean, at some point.
Unless it's compliance driven or legally driven or insurance driven.
Yes. Yep. I can see that happening. I just don't think people get it yet. I really
Oh.
don't think people get it yet. So, anyway,
Yeah.
we beat that horse to death.
But you know, that's our job. We're supposed to talk about mitigations, and that's a tough one.
It is. It is. We need to come back to that for sure. Okay. Moving on. So, Sophos and Ponemon, my favorite report company.
Which I always read as Pokemon. I'm sorry, I can't help it.
Oh, I have to tell you a funny story. So there's another podcast. I know it's surprising there's another podcast, but it's the Southern Fried Security, and they're also very critical of Ponemon. And about a year ago, they were talking about a report he released, and I hadn't paid attention to the graphic on my iPhone, and I looked down, and it was Pikachu, and I just about lost it.
Nice.
So anyway, yes, it is definitely reminds me of Pokemon. So the one thing, it's obviously a very Ponemon reports are used by a lot of companies to do a lot of internal justification, right? One thing I want to make sure that I hopefully can impart on everybody is this kind of report is not a technical analysis of data. This is an opinion report. This is an opinion survey. This is like calling people up and saying, "Who do you think should be president? Are you pro or against, banning guns?" That's what this is, right? It's not more than that. It's not getting in and looking at data. It is feeling out opinions on different topics. And I think
And
there.
to be clear, topics of SMBs
Yes.
who, just to be clear, because not to steal any thunder or to, jump ahead in the lead, when you're asking companies about security incidents and security states, SMBs are the least likely to have accurate and correct and actually gathered any stats or any sort of knowledge around these things that is reality based. It's all gut, it's all just opinion.
It's a great point. Very good point.
As opposed to large enterprises who have, metrics and stats and tickets and, how many incidents they respond to and blah, 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 blah,
Yeah.
right?
So from that perspective, I think if you view this report as an opinion and an analysis on people's perception about different things, I think it is somewhat interesting, right? So some of the more, you know, the more tactile data that they present, I don't think is very useful. But when you look at what it presents as far as how people view definitions and things like that, I do think it's interesting because it is somewhat telling about attitudes in the industry.
Sure.
So, you know, kind of walking through, I made some notes about some of the things I saw as interesting, you know, and one of them was that they have this table about the challenges of IT security, and they call it cybersecurity, but I'm going to call it IT security because I'm having a bad week. So,
and I make fun of you whenever you use the word cyber.
Yeah, I know that too. So they say 58% of the respondents said that management doesn't see IT attacks as a risk. 44% see IT security as not a priority. 42% there's not enough budget for it. And 33% lack in-house skills. You know, what's interesting is that it's all the same problem.
Yeah.
It's every one of those is just a different way of describing the same problem that your management, from your perception or from your view, doesn't see this as a problem. And, you know, what's more interesting is there's no context to say whether it actually is a problem or is not a problem. All this is saying is that these people interviewed believed there is a problem.
Yeah, they think there's a problem, and they think their management doesn't think there is. So all we're really finding here is that somebody disagreed with management.
Yes.
Which, yes. Shocking.
Yes, exactly.
But to be fair, I do think, you know, SMB in a, you know, and I apologize for the technical language. When I really take a look at the SMB state against security threats, you know, it's a big word. But I think the appropriate categorization of their situation is screwed.
That's technical right there.
It is. They really are. They don't have the budget. They don't have the people. They don't have the time. They're just trying to keep their business afloat. And I love small business. I'm an entrepreneur by nature. And I rock on, buddies. Go drive the economy. But this is one area where they just don't have the capital to invest in enterprise level security that you really need to do, much less the staffing to address these issues.
But you know, one thing you have to, there's a couple of different ways you can look at that. Number one is when you start off in business, you take a lot of things for liberty and you take a lot of risks.
And yeah, exactly.
This is not a lot of different. And so, you know, if you're in that low end, if you're in the, you know, the lower end business and you are having to put all of your money into R&D or sales or whatever, and you don't have money to invest in security, you don't have money to invest in security.
Yeah, you just have to take the risk. You don't have a choice.
Exactly.
And it's a tough risk to take. It could be potentially business ending. You don't know. But it may not be.
Right.
And that, of course, is the challenge, right? You don't know. And this is an unknown.
Yeah, and then there's another category where the IT people do a very bad job of conveying what the risk is.
Well, because, you know, part of it is all the vendors are spewing such FUD to sell their stuff and to, you know, talk about the worst case scenarios. We talk about the worst case scenarios because it's sexy, it's fun, it's interesting, right? It's, you know, it's our version of James Bond, you know, or whatever. And I'm, you know, old and cynical, so, you know, I don't look at it like that I used to. But the reality is we, you know, it is tough to say to a small business executive, if you don't do X, Y will occur. Whereas, you know, like legal counsel or accounting or other folks can advise them and say, if you don't, you know, craft your contract in a specific way and spend this amount of money on legal, this is what will happen to you. It's difficult to justify security spend for small businesses.
Yeah. Yep. Don't disagree.
So anyway, I completely took you off your point, but, nope. You know, that's what I'm here to do. Just disrupt the show.
All right. The next stat I thought was interesting was that 51% of those interviewed reported that there was loss or exposure of sensitive information, and that's, you know, that's not all that interesting unto itself. I would say there's probably about 49% that aren't aware that it probably has happened.
Sure.
But what was more interesting to me was the table that decomposed that. And so they basically said, well, you know, for those 51%, how did that happen? The number one reported category was third parties, you know, and I thought that was really interesting because, you know, I'm left wondering, is it really third parties or are they a really convenient patsy?
Yeah. Yeah, seriously. Though, to be fair, if you look at this chart, all the answers add up to way more than 100%. So clearly they could pick multiple things.
Yes.
So, which is interesting because a root cause usually is, you know, a sole root cause typically. But more than one response was permitted.
There's a lot of criticisms that can be levied against Ponemon reports.
Well, yeah. Yeah. But you're right. You know, your initial... You know, if you look at it as a perception issue, it gives you the state of perception, which
exactly
for these guys becomes their reality, whether it's founded in reality or not, it's their reality.
Right.
Anyway, go on.
It's, you know, 58% basically said it wasn't anything we did. It was a different company, third party. 47% said it was a negligent employee or contractor. 44% didn't know. You know. Anyway, those are survey results. The next one I thought that was really interesting was the definition of an APT. You know, this is starting to get into some interesting psychology. And there's really only two that I thought were pretty interesting that, you know, both of them were 33%. So 33% of those interviewed said that APTs are recurrent low-profile targeted attacks. And 33% said they're not sure. And then there's a whole bunch of single digits saying it's things like denial of service and hacktivists and crap like that. And so anyway, I thought that was interesting that a third of people in apparently IT security roles don't have a view on what APTs actually are.
Yeah.
Interesting. Now, possibly the most scary statistic I saw was there's a section in here about technology or the views of technology and their importance to blocking attacks. Yeah,
that was the one I was going to zero in on.
Holy moly. So I'm only going to, you know, it's mind-bending, right? So 74% of respondents said AV is the number, you know, that's the number one technology now. It's 89% in the future, you know, as being important to defending against IT attacks. I'm really stunned.
Well, you know what this tells me? And so the top three, by the way, just for sake, setting up my comment here, AV, client firewalls, and endpoint management were the top three. The bottom three, unified threat management, web application firewalls, big data analytics. Fourth from the bottom was data loss prevention. Fifth from the bottom, automated patch management systems. What this tells me more than anything is that SMB is about 5 years behind enterprise in their view of what it takes to do proper IT security, and that they are, they're just, and it's understandable. They don't have the cycles, right? So you look at what was introduced first, right? Firewalls and AV, and that's the world they're still living in, you know, somewhat by necessity.
I'm very painfully familiar with the thought that AV is the answer. And man, it just given the context of what's been happening over the past couple of years, it's really hard for me to wrap my head around how people can still think this.
Much like the government, AV is not the answer. AV is the problem.
So, you know, I this is one of those areas where I think if we get educated about the situation and the threat that we are facing, And clearly to me, that table is very telling that in general, at least the target audience in the survey doesn't really have a great grasp on that.
And that's understandable, right? I mean, they don't have the means to employ, you know, high-end security guys or even, you know, security consultancies typically. Their IT guys are typically generalists who are focused on running SMB and, you know, thin margins and small budgets. And
you know, Symantec is really expensive. It must be worth it, right? All right. The last thing in there was, there were two more things. The second to last is that the cost of damage or theft to IT assets is lower than the cost to downtime to normal operations. And that's kind of a complicated statistic, and it's really not a statistic too, because this is, again, feeling based, emotion based. But basically, you know, it's honestly not entirely clear when you actually read the question if what they were trying to drive at. My interpretation is that if you have a breach and that breach, let's say, impacts both your operations and IT, which costs more? Is it the recovery of the IT side, or is it the loss to operations? So, you know, did you lose money in your sales or productivity or whatever? And in every case, in every industry and every size business that was represented in the study, everybody says they believe that the cost to to operations is higher than the cost to IT. Now, again, we don't know if that's actually true. All this is saying is that that's people's belief.
Yeah.
So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it is.
And then the last thing was, and this should come as no surprise to anyone, that the higher you go up in the organization, the more uncertainty you have about the security state of your organization.
When you say higher, you mean as in position?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep. All right. So next story. This one, you actually sent this one to me, and I thought it was pretty interesting. It came from... this comes from Network World, and again, it comes from a vendor, right? Interviewed with a vendor. I think it was Dambala, right? Yeah, Dambala.
Yeah.
I think it was worth talking about just very briefly. Basically, there's been quite a number of very high-profile botnet command and control infrastructure takedowns. And in fact, I think it was at RSA, CrowdStrike did one live, if I recall.
They struck the crowd live?
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, they did a live botnet command and control takedown.
For the record, that joke sounded much better in my head.
I can only imagine.
Sorry.
It's all right. We'll let it pass. So anyway, the point of the article is that these botnet takedowns are good PR, but they don't actually yield any benefits or much benefit.
Yeah, it's interesting. So this came from a blog post on Dambala's blog by Brian Foster, their CTO. I think he's like number seven, seventh CTO. And full disclosure, I used to work at Dambala, so you know, take that for what it's worth. It's interesting. And he has a point, right? You know, there's lots of different ways that these guys can just spin up another botnet. But, you know, I can argue something back on this, which is that we saw repeatedly hardcore statistical evidence when big spam botnets were taken down, big cuts in spam. So now that may only last a couple of months, but we have seen that. So, you know, I think more than anything, I think what he's calling out is be thorough if you're going to go after a takedown and don't just do it for press reasons. And I would agree with that.
Yeah, I agree. And I think also it kind of alludes to that it's getting more difficult.
Yeah, and you know,
take it all down.
the flip side of this, much like the rant we had earlier about when a vendor is talking about these things, is, you know, they're in the business of selling devices that spot botnet compromise hosts in their in your environment, right? So in part, his job is to make sure that the, you know, customer base is still afraid of botnets, right? You know, and I'm not saying he's wrong or right or indifferent, but I'm saying that there is that motivation there.
Yeah, and absolutely.
So, you know, it's for him to keep saying, yeah, that's great that all these guys are taking out botnets, but you still need to buy your stuff.
Yeah. Yep. Fair enough. All right, moving on. Next one comes from InfoWorld. And the title is Cybercrime Forum Advertises Financial Malware That Uses Stealthy I2P Communications.
Tell me, Jerry, what is I2P?
It is the Invisible Internet Project. So you can think about it as a similar to Tor, but a little bit, I would say, probably done a little better, actually. It's a little more anonymous than even Tor is. But it's definitely not as popular. So this piece of malware is called i2Ninja. And kind of like we saw with some recent pieces of malware that use Tor for command and control. And again, related back to the last story, the advantage there is once you host your command and control infrastructure in one of these anonymizing networks, it becomes very difficult to execute a takedown because you really don't know where they're at, unless, let's say, you're the NSA and you know,
yeah.
So the point I bring up, there isn't anything particularly notable about this piece of malware other than that it is using I2P for its command and control. It is that, you know, and you may disagree, right? But I don't see any particular reason for a business to be allowing I2P and Tor traffic into and out of its network. I just think it's a bad idea.
So I agree with you, right? You know, outbound filtering is absolutely valuable. And back in the day, we used to do proxies at the edge and not have default routes.
Yeah.
Which as a network guy was very annoying and frustrating to work with. And the needs of business eventually went to stateful firewall inspection, really popularized by Checkpoint, and pretty much proxies died for the most part, aside from web proxies. Don't know why I'm giving a history lesson here, but the point is I actually was very curious about this, and I went and started doing some research in I2P, and blocking it is non-trivial. It's really meant by design to get out. Mm-hmm. And get through firewalls and get through NAT. And I did some looking. Like, I went out to Palo Alto because they're supposed to be very application aware. And they are aware of I2P. They categorize it. They appear to be able to spot it and drop it. I haven't verified that, but it's at least in their application database. But they're one of the few. Like, I did a lot of searching just on blocking I2P, and it is not well known. There's not a lot of people talking about how to block it. There's a lot of people who are sort of like on Reddit and stuff talking about, hey, how do I get this through this? But from a defensive standpoint, this is not very well known yet. And it has the ability to find all sorts of randomized open ports and is, you know, pretty robust in finding ways out. So it's not a simple thing. Like, it's not as simple as blocking, you know, port 4444 UDP.
Yeah. So, you know, call your firewall and IPS vendor and ask them when you can block I2P.
But it's something we should know about. And it's something that, you know, we should, in general, not be allowing, for lots of reasons, random outbound traffic unless there's a good reason. But that is a pain. Right, from administrative overhead, that's a cultural issue that a lot of companies have trouble dealing with. But it's, you know, best practice.
It is. You know, I would go so far as to say, if I know with Tor, I feel, you know, Tor is relatively easy to detect with IPS and IDS. Most of the major vendors have signatures for Tor, and
yeah.
Like you said, I2P is kind of nascent. It's really not been on the radar. It's kind of nascent, mm-hmm. But you know, definitely with Tor and now with I2P, I view these as targets of opportunity, right? So if you see something in your environment talking out on Tor, that's something you should go take a look at.
Right.
You know, is it malware? Is it one of your employees trying to download wares? Is it them, you know, doing something inappropriate? There probably isn't a valid business reason for them to be using Tor.
Hold on. Unless you worked for a lot of companies like we've worked for, where there's all sorts of valid reasons. Research and knowledge gathering and...
And I will use the same logic that we did then. That needs to be done in the appropriate kind of environment.
Agreed. Management rarely does, but I agree with you. We tried hard. So,
yeah, well, I think we did a pretty good job.
But point being, the real point is you need to understand if there is a business use, right? You can't go willy-nilly block things or you'll hurt your own credibility. You Absolutely. Have to understand, and you have to have management backing, and you need to have management buy-off. They need to own this decision, not you as a security practitioner. They need to own the risk, and they need to own the decision.
Yeah, and I would say even further to that point is, you know, if there is a valid business reason for it to be used, it probably doesn't make sense. And I think this goes for any kind of similar type of scenario where you run in there and say, you can't do that. You know, it's that's not the discussion. It's okay. You can't do that there. Let's figure out the right place to do it, the right way to do it.
Yeah. What are you trying to achieve?
Exactly.
Let me design a solution that minimizes company risk to a certain acceptable degree while still allowing you to achieve what you want to achieve at a reasonable cost.
Right.
And try to get everybody to believe to agree and herd cats and sing kumbaya. And
sometimes it's not it
easy.
Works.
It's not easy.
Sometimes it works. And so, you know, sometimes you, I mean, you know, I can't remember the timing, right? But you know, I had a lot of luck later in one of our previous employers setting up a very full featured environment, and so we had a lot of people wanting to do a lot of really crazy things
right.
on production networks, and so you know what I said was, well, hey, you know, what about you not do that on our normal network, and we set up like this entire separate network that looks like a different company on a different internet connection, you know, totally different, and they loved it.
Yeah,
and you know, it was a win-win, right? It was better for them. They liked it more than what they had before. And so it was, you know, they actually preferred it. So anyway, the last story we have, there's a guy named Ralph Langer. And Ralph was one of the very first people involved in responding to the Stuxnet worm back in what was it, 2009, 2010. And he just released, after 3 years of work, apparently, his dissertation on his analysis of Stuxnet. And it's quite a paper. I think it's, you know, what is it, 30-some pages
36,
long.
36.
36 pages long.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not going to go through all of it, but I did write down quite a few key messages that I thought were worth sharing. So I'll go through those because I learned a lot, right? I mean, I think I followed Stuxnet and the story of Stuxnet probably closer than most people because I've worked in the industrial environment. I've actually programmed pretty extensively industrial controls and whatnot and, you know, designed.
Is that what you were doing in Iran for all those years?
Yes.
This explains a few things.
Woo. Yeah. Don't tell anybody.
The helicopters will be there shortly.
Hopefully this doesn't get out to anybody.
That's right. All two of our listeners will.
Yes. So anyway, I personally found the story interesting because, you know, I had that experience with the industrial side of the house. And now I'm obviously on the InfoSec side. So it was pretty interesting to me. So the first key message I picked up was that there were two separate variants of Stuxnet. There was an early version and a later version. And the early version was actually much more complicated and advanced and sophisticated than the later version, which is kind of counterintuitive. it just very, very from a high, very high level, the first version was designed to be very, very subtle and attacked attacked the process. Basically, it was designed to disable some pressure relief valves, and so occasionally will cause an overpressure situation, which wouldn't destroy these centrifuges. It would just reduce the life, and it was designed to mask what it was doing. So, if you were looking at any of the monitors or control system screens, you wouldn't see what was going on. The second version was more aggressive, and it was designed to attack the motors. So it was designed to overspin the centrifuges, and it had apparently had to propagate in a different method than the first one. And it was a little more aggressive, but a little less sophisticated. And another thing was, and this was something that was really opaque to me, was, as I mentioned, this wasn't designed to destroy the centrifuges. These were just designed to reduce the lifespan of the centrifuges, and it was probably even more so designed to make the operators of this control plant or this plant crazy, because it would just cause odd things to happen, and it would be odd to the point where they would be scratching their head, but not significantly odd to the point where they would feel like they need to go and do a really thorough audit of all the code on the controllers and stuff.
Which is the sweet spot, right?
That's yes.
Where you want to be.
Yep. Now here's where it starts to get kind of interesting, because Ralph Langer, that is, speculates that the second version, because it is such a fairly drastic departure from the first, and again, high level, the first was a hacked version of the command, the control software that you use to program the controllers, and so it was pretty basic, didn't propagate. All it did was allow you to program the controllers, and it inserted some of its own logic. The second one used a bunch of zero days in Windows, and it didn't try to mimic the control system software and whatnot. But his observation is that it was designed to be found, and the reason he says that is, well, the way he's got a really great quote in here that he says that the U.S. doesn't want another Sputnik moment. Yeah. And so he's saying that this was seen as an opportunity to demonstrate that, the cyber warfare superiority of the U.S., and that while uranium enrichment plants are going to come and go, there will only ever be one first cyber weapon.
So this is kind of the equivalent of a U.S. nuclear submarine surfacing under Arctic ice pack to show we can do it.
Yes.
Or surfacing in, a very protected coastal water to show, hey, look where we went.
Yeah.
It's a display of power. And, certainly I have no insider knowledge to know if that's true or not, but that does track with typical foreign policy and typical sort of geopolitics of being able to show, hey, we did this and we can do it again. So that's interesting. It's an interesting theory. And I kind of buy into it a little bit.
Yeah. And, there's pretty widespread agreement that Stuxnet didn't actually have a significant impact on Natanz and their ability to process uranium. And one of the points he makes is that at the end of the day, both versions of Stuxnet were designed to attack the centrifuges. And Iran had built a gigantic stockpile of spare centrifuge parts. And so, they could break all day long, And, you know, they could keep replacing parts and it wouldn't, you know, wouldn't materially impact their ability to produce. And, but, you know, it's very clear that that's not what they were after. And, you know, the other thing is, and, you know, this isn't stated in the article, but this is an observation of mine, is that the timing of the, you know, when the more aggressive, let's not hide it anymore stance seems to coincide shortly after President Obama taking office, you know?
Well, we're certainly kind of getting into some, you know, interesting topics here. But, you know, one thing that I think is going on as well is Israel's been pushing hard to do a military kinetic strike against Iran. And it always surprised me that they didn't do it before Bush left office. And I think one of the reasons they didn't do it is because we must have shared with them and worked with them on these sorts of non-kinetic options.
What was going on, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Again, I have no insider knowledge of that. I have no, you know, this is not in any way a disclosure of classified information. Please don't arrest me. This is just purely my speculation. Hang on, there are feds at my door. I got to go.
And, you know, I'm just going based on what's in here. And actually, what made me draw that connection was he has as an inset in one of the pages a press release about I think it was some leaked information about, you know, Obama orders the military to step up operations. And, you know, that's like the light bulb goes on. Well, you know, there you go. That how else do you step it up than make sure people are aware of it. And another great quote he has in here is that, you know, you don't have the ability to parade a USB device down the street in a military parade. You know, so you
got to
get it out there somehow.
It's just not very exciting.
Exactly.
What's that guy holding?
So, you know, moving on, there was another interesting aspect in that he pointed out, and that's that Stuxnet did not break out. So if you recall, there was a lot of hoopla about how Stuxnet was being found all over the place. And he points out that the first version of Stuxnet had no propagation ability at all, right? It was just a hacked version of the programming software. The second version did have some propagation. It would propagate to USB devices, and it would also propagate across a local network, not across the internet, but across a local network. And the thinking was that, again, whoever designed this, presumably the government here, did it and wrote it intentionally so that they could potentially discover other unknown nuclear facilities, right? So if you had a whole bunch of people working at, let's say, Natanz, and then their computers get compromised with this thing, and then they go over to, you know, some other unknown facility, and they plug in, now, you know, they contaminate that facility too, and the government obviously potentially gets some information about unknown facilities that way. So his hypothesis, and actually he pretty strongly asserts this, is that all of that propagation was done via USB sharing and people putting contaminated or infected laptops on different networks, which is pretty interesting from a virology perspective.
Yeah, there's valid intelligence there, right? Knowing how it spreads, knowing the connections. Absolutely valid intelligence.
Yeah.
And you got to wonder if there wasn't something that was purely just a callback mechanism distributed before that, right? You know, to do more recon and intelligence.
Well, you know, he doesn't get into Gauss and Flame and Dooku, but it was Dooku, if I recall, was hypothesized to predate Stuxnet by a couple of years, and the thinking was that potentially was the reconnaissance engine. So anyway,
30 years from now, there'll be books out and we can know.
Absolutely. The next, you know, there's a couple more observations I have here. The next was,
you know, in our show notes, you said brief mention.
Sorry, I did say brief. I lied. It was deception.
Carry on.
Deception. That this is a solid methodology for future types of attacks. You know, that this is going to be a, kind of as you mentioned, right? This is going to be studied as kind of the de facto model for future kinds of attacks. You know, now we have a, you know, we've got kind of a methodology behind this. The next thing he said was that successful attacks like this don't need to exploit zero-day vulnerabilities in control systems. And I know that's an interesting observation, because there's a lot of people running around right now really whipped up into a frenzy about, you know, how the industrial control systems really are pretty bad. You know, they haven't been assessed from a security standpoint. And his point is, you don't need a zero day. You know, these things will do bad stuff all on their own. All you got to do is give it, you know, the kind of code that you want it to execute, and it'll do it all day long. You don't need a zero day to get that code in the front door.
Yeah, that's true.
Let's see. Another observation was that this is obvious, right? It's far easier to infect a really hardened environment using a contractor than it is to get through their IT security systems. And apparently that is believed how Stuxnet got in. Let's see what other. Oh, he did say he sees a potential opportunity for exploit kit type models for industrial control systems in the future, right? That it's not inconceivable that we would see some attack organization or some criminal enterprise or government create, you know, like a black hole or, you know, one of those style kits that are kind of modular for different kinds of control systems, different kinds of environments. I thought that was really interesting. And the last thing, and I think this is really important, is probably not just from the perspective of this kind of environment, but I'd say everywhere, right? That the current mitigation technology that we have, like antivirus and IPS and patching and network segmentation, totally failed here, right? We had air gap networks. They had AV. They had patch systems, right? These attacks took, you know, they bypassed the air gap networks using sneakernet on USBs. They used zero days that weren't patched. You know, they used malware that wasn't detectable by viruses or by AV packages. So none of the contemporary stuff that we've got out there could actually defend against this.
No, but you could go back to detection, right? Grabbing the CNC and the exfiltration and some of the other stuff going on, you know, and you know, I would be curious, right? What happens if you threw a Stuxnet back in the day before we knew about it at a modern day FireEye? What would it have detected? Probably not much, because it wasn't hooked up to a CNC, not a CNC, but you know what I mean? So it goes back to assume you're going to get owned, and then how do you detect those incidents of, you know, compromise and those communications on the wire as best you can. And
now Langer in a different paper, and I read this probably about 6 months ago, he released a different paper about at least in the industrial setting, and he kind of viewed it as a alternative to the federal government cybersecurity executive order. And he was looking at it more from the perspective of how would we defend a plant against something like this? And it was much more tactical. You know, let's inspect the code that's running on the controller, see if it's been altered on a periodic basis, and you know, look at who has who has opened that panel, and you know, and make sure that they're authorized, that sort of stuff, which is you know, a possibility. I think you're right, though. We have to get a lot more sensitive to being able to detect when anomalous things happen. But I have to think that as that area of technology begins to mature, and the more advanced adversaries know that's happening, I would bet that, you know, this is going to move more into, you know, deeper into the shadows using, you know, steganography or, you know, something else.
Yeah, it's tough. Then you look at a whitelisting solution. You look at, you know, it's a tough problem, and it's. Yeah.
Yep.
But I know we're running
way over. We're way over. But
breaking news, I'm going to surprise Jerry with this one, is that one of the new Snowden documents came out indicates that the NSA has malware on at least 50,000 foreign boxes. At least.
That's
good times.
Awesome.
I'm glad our government is running their own botnet. That's helpful.
Well, it's to save the children.
Your tax dollars are worked.
It's for the children.
It is for the children. It's for clean water and children. And Bambi.
You know,
puppies.
I really feel pretty strongly that if you were to fast forward, you know, 50 years, this is going to be potentially one of the most monumental, disastrous eras in U.S. government history, because we are really beginning to see the, you know, the trust in not only the U.S. government but U.S. companies eroding in other parts of the world, and you know that's just a bad thing.
Yes.
Not a lot more to say about it than that.
Yeah, yes.
It's unfortunate, and we've got to, you know, somehow, some way, somebody's got to get their arms around it. I don't know what that means, but man, somebody smarter than me's got to take the reins here.
I think Belize looks nice.
Well, how did that work out for John McAfee?
Overall, pretty well. Look at the stories he gets to tell at the bar. I mean,
that's true. It's true.
One, if you're going to move to Belize, don't be batshit crazy. I think that is what we learned from John McAfee's.
That, yeah, I can agree with that.
And on that stirring note,
let's call it a day.
Yes, we'll skip our attack of the week due to lots of stories to code that we covered. But next week, I think we should talk about certain consultative engagements.
Yes.
Like how best to utilize a pen tester, I think may be an interesting discussion.
Let's do it.
All right.
All right. Thank you very much. It was a great, great discussion. Hopefully everybody listening enjoyed it as well, and we didn't bore you to tears. I like to think not. If you did like this podcast, hey, you know, tell somebody. Get the word out. You know, get our numbers above 10 or so. That'd be cool. Drop some positive feedback into iTunes. That'd be cool too. You can find us on Twitter. The show's Twitter handle is @DefensiveSec. Mr. Kalitz is @Lurg. Mine is @MaliciousLink. You can find the show and the show notes for all the things we talk about on the website at www.defensivesecurity.org. And with that, I wish you all a pleasant week. And for those here in the U.S., have a good Thanksgiving.
Take care, guys. Thanks.
Bye.